Hi, I'm Dave Reinersman. Welcome to The Marvels of Science, a podcast about the science and tech of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. All your favorite heroes and villains from Black Panther and Ant-Man to Baron Zemo and Iron Man. Today on the show, we're spending some more time talking about all things tiny. Not Ant-Man tiny, a bit bigger than that. We're getting into the world of nanotech. Here with me to sort nano-reality from nano-fiction and nano conspiracy theory is Eric Breckenfeld, our science expert today. Eric is a materials scientist who is formerly of the National Nanotechnology Initiative and is now at DARPA. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you very much, Dave. I'm really glad to be here.
And our color commentator is Sarah Miller. Sarah is an English teacher and former DC resident, now in the other Washington. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Sarah.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
In episode 4, Vibranium, with Suvine Mathadu and Lauren Bland, we briefly touched on the concept of nanotechnology when talking about Black Panther's supersuit. We also strayed briefly into QAnon territory with mentions of nanites. I am bracing myself for the onslaught of nonsensical conspiracy theory-laden emails, but let's dig in. Sarah, you're an English teacher, and if I LinkedIn stalked you accurately, you were the head of the department when you were teaching in DC. But how's your general science knowledge? Is it a subject you feel comfortable in, or is it more of a foreign land?
You know, I enjoy science. Science is fun. Science is real. But my science knowledge definitely ended with high school. I did, when I was doing graduate studies at St. John's College in Annapolis, I did take a semester's worth of courses in natural science, but it was more science philosophy. So reading Plato and Bacon and Darwin. Nanotechnology is about 150 years later than where the St. John's curriculum stopped, at least. So I'm kind of a neophyte in this area, but happy to learn.
So if you had to encapsulate all of your nanotechnology knowledge, what do you think nanotechnology is?
I think nanotechnology is technology about things that are really small. And I only say this because I think nano comes from Greek. It's related to the concept or the word small. I don't know exactly what it translates as, but I'm going to guess that nanotechnology is about things that are really small.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's, well, nano is tiny, so tiny technology. I think we generally associate the word nano with a nanometer, a billionth of a meter. But sometimes, like with the planetary science episode next week, I'm starting with some knowledge on the subject, which is often dangerously oversimplified. But here, it looks like both of us are starting from square one. So Eric, can we get a definition first? What is nanotechnology specifically?
Yeah, well, the good news is that your intuitions are pretty much spot on. So, you know, we typically define nanotechnology as technologies that leverage structures or phenomena that occur on a scale from, you know, one to several hundred nanometers. And this is actually quite a wide range of measurements. One to 100 nanometers encompasses quite a lot of different processes and materials and structures that we find in modern technology and in nature. So I would say that, you know, although nanotechnology perhaps began at its inception a long, long time ago, almost as an aspiration and then as kind of a buzzword, where it started getting, you know, especially in the early 2000s, where the, you know, nano started getting thrown into all sorts of technology pitches and these sorts of things. It's very much transcended beyond that, where it is neither aspirational nor a buzzword. And indeed, it's infused in almost every technology that we're used to today. I mean, nanotechnology is in your smartphones. Nanotechnology is in so many things that it's almost mind-boggling to think of the scope of modern technology that actually leverages these things in a way that we don't think about.
That's illuminating. I didn't really think of the idea that it was started as a buzzword and then move into reality. That reminds me, though, Sarah, did you have an iPod Nano?
You know, Dave, I did not, but I was just going to say, wasn't there an iPod named an iPod Nano that was super small and like could clip onto your shirt or something
like
that?
Yeah, with no screen, no way to tell what you were actually playing. It just had like play, pause, next, and last.
That's right.
That's right. Larger, much larger than a nanometer, I'll say that.
So, Eric, does that mean that nanotechnology, like obviously the things that make use of nanotechnology are not nano themselves?
Often that is the case, yes.
Okay, and then it is like the things that you can learn and make use of from the really small that then can lead to breakthroughs that aren't necessarily themselves physically that small.
Yeah, well, a lot of it too is, you know, how can we leverage our knowledge of physical phenomena that happen at the nanoscale into making a big effect on macro scale devices, or even in, for example, in our own bodies, right? So a lot of nanotechnology and a lot of phenomena that happen at the nanoscale are highly relevant. These are phenomena that happen in molecules, phenomena that happen at the scale of a virus, for example. And so a lot of knowledge that we gain from that goes into medicine. It goes into how do our materials behave at these very small scales, which, as it turns out, are responsible for their much larger scale behavior. And so even though what we're studying is behavior at the nanoscale, it often, because these things are happening a billion times inside this volume of material, even though the scale of the phenomenon is 1/1,000,000,000, it has an enormous effect on the properties of the physical object, or on the health of your cells, or on all sorts of things that are relevant at a scale we'd be more familiar
with. It reminds me a bit of, if you've heard of Schrodinger's cat, the fact that people use this as an explanation for quantum phenomena would drive Schrodinger crazy, because Schrodinger's cat was a critique of the whole concept. And he said, you're telling me that because you think this quantum particle can be in both of these states simultaneously, but you can't tell which until you look at it, that if I set one of those up and I connect it to a hammer, connect it to some poison that's going to kill a cat, if I set that thing in a box and don't look, the cat is both dead and alive? That's what you're trying to tell me? So taking this incredibly small scale phenomenon and then looking at its macro scale effects, he was like, this can't happen. This doesn't make any sense. Cats are either dead or alive. They're not both. So you must be wrong, was his point. I'm not going to include that. That's quite the tangent, but that's where my mind went with looking at small scale things to look at their larger scale impacts.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, although I say we look to the nanoscale phenomenon to try to engineer larger scale effects, I don't mean to say that those large scale objects behave analogously to the nanoscale phenomenon. You know, I'll give you an example. Even just take your smartphone in your pocket. Those are based on computation technology. And the computation technology is based on the transistor, which is a small electronic gate that will perform logic operations. And the size of that little logical element is on the scale in the most advanced electronics of maybe 5 nanometers.
Wow.
Now, when I put billions of those together, even though they are 5 nanometers, you know, the device doesn't behave like one of those. The smartphone doesn't behave like one single transistor. But I need to understand how that transistor behaves on a nanoscale level if I want to understand how aggregating billions of them together will produce some larger scale effect.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, in the MCU, we get a few explicit mentions of nanotechnology. Let's hit those first. In Avengers Age of Ultron, Clint, Hawkeye, gets shot and is wounded pretty badly as Dr. Helen Cho patches him up with some space-age CGI and tells him,
there's no possibility of deterioration. The nanomolecular functionality is instantaneous. His cells don't know they're bonding with simulacrum.
Clint quips about being made of plastic a bit, but doesn't really seem bothered. Sarah, would it wig you out at all to have synthetic skin replacing some of yours, even if you couldn't tell?
I mean, I'd like to think that it wouldn't wig me out, but I think what would perhaps more is if there was some kind of change or growth in my own skin as a consequence of that. We talk about this actually in my philosophy and literature class with my seniors last trimester, just to try and like piece out theories and philosophies around personal identity. Are you still you if you have a bionic arm? Are you still you if you have a prosthetic eye or a heart transplant or something like that, or a pacemaker? And one of my students wondered about the possibility of some part of a body that isn't human being attached to a human body and somehow changing the other parts of the body. I think that is pretty mind-blowing to wonder about. I don't even know if that's medically possible, but it's in my brain.
That kid probably reads a lot of cyberpunk, I would imagine.
It's making a comeback.
Eric, what do you make of this mention of nanotech, or at least nano? Is there anything here that's analogous to any real-world nanotechnology?
I would say that, you know, this idea of artificial cells or some kind of technological replacement for, you know, closing up a wound or maybe artificial skin, absolutely, it is something that is possible and is looked into. Although I would say that if you're going to be leveraging nanotechnology to do replacements for the body or to do healing, the best thing you can do is to use the nanotechnology to boost the body's own healing. So rather than applying artificial skin, if I could find a way to do some kind of nanotechnology enhanced stem cell solution of, you know, perhaps even your own stem cells that I could apply as a spray and you could grow back your own skin very quickly. This is technology that has been demonstrated, perhaps a more advanced version of that or something that was, you know, enhanced with maybe nano delivered nutrients in some sort of small nano encapsulation to make cells grow faster. These sorts of things certainly could be valuable, but I don't know if you'd need to make the compromise necessarily by accepting a foreign technology. I think that the technology exists to enhance your own healing for things like regrowing skin.
Interesting. It's important to note that in the movie, they don't explain what they're doing. She just sprays some goop on him, says that line, and then pieces out.
It's not so crazy. There is goop that will help you regrow your skin. That has been a development.
This is why this conversation or set of conversations that you're having, Dave, is so interesting. You mentioned just a minute ago that this term is just thrown about.
Do you guys just put the word quantum in front of everything?
It's not really explained. And as a casual viewer of all of these Marvel movies, I just sort of hear all of this science and I wonder, that could be real, that could not be real, and move on. And I assume that if they don't explain it to me, it's not central to the plot. But I think that's interesting. That's part of why these conversations are cool.
You know, on the point of including philosophy in these, I think that's sort of where our minds were at a little bit earlier when we talked about if a piece of technology is integrated into your body, is that you? And it's something that we'll have to, I think, ask more frequently as technology advances is, you know, obviously technology integrated into your body is not genetically you. But if there's a piece of technology that provides sensory input to you, when you look at like artificial limbs for soldiers who've lost it in combat, the amount of functionality that's starting to get integrated into those, oftentimes enabled by nanotechnology and nanoelectronics, they can get sensory feedback. They can feel things with those arms, right? They can feel pressure. They can feel temperature. And so if you're getting sensory feedback from an artificial appendage, I mean, it's not genetically you, but in a sense, it is kind of part of you, right? I mean, it has a direct line of information to your brain.
And if you then make choices in response to those sensory inputs,
yeah,
or if it allows you to persist like a pacemaker would, right?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
If that conversation about prosthetics interests you, come back for episode 18 when I talk to prosthetics resident Doterra Conway and prosthetist Tony Gutierrez.
Ooh, that'll be fun.
In Black Panther, Wakanda's resident super genius Shuri shows off the new Black Panther supersuit to her brother T'Challa. It's made of nanites, unexplained tiny machines that can do two notable things seen in the movie. One, they're stored in a necklace until called upon, and then spill out in seconds to cover T'Challa, forming the suit. And two, they can absorb energy from punches, kicks, and even bullets, later releasing that energy as a pulse of purple, basically, like a force field punch bubble that hits back at the bad guys. Sarah, I'm about to use the phrase wig out again because I grew up in the 90s. Would it wig you out to have a swarm of tiny machines covering you like a suit?
Yes. Yes, I think it would wig me out whether or not I was the one activating it. I think having all of those things crawl across your body would feel strange. Though I would, to be fair, also be wigging out if that was necessary, right? If I was in a situation where I needed a suit of some kind like that. I don't think that my reaction skills would be as calm and cool and collected as the superheroes always seem to be when they're about to enter a fight. I'm technically a Gryffindor, but, you know.
I like that that's a technicality.
Yeah, it's because I like to win, not because I'm like itching for a fight.
Eric, the first part of that, the necklace full of nanites that then swarms over you and forms a suit. Is there anything there that we can say might be realistic?
So it's interesting, of course, that every time you get into a conversation about nanotechnology, eventually we will have to broach the topic of the nanite as it has been in science fiction for so long and occupies such a portion of the cultural awareness of nanotechnology. I'll say two things. First of all, indeed, you already are covered in a skin of nanites because it's your skin's natural biome and it is full of microscopic and nanoscopic life and not life viruses and these sorts of things. So we're already being crawled all over.
Well, Now I need to go take a shower. Thanks.
Yeah. And that is part of what makes us healthy, actually. Having a healthy skin biome is important. And, you know, it's interesting. So the reason I say that ties into the nanite. Now, the nanite, as it's presented in science fiction, often is a substance that can do whatever the writer needs it to do, right? Because it is engineered at such a small scale that you can't see how it's doing it, but it can do anything. And so although I wouldn't say that there's no foundation of this idea of a nano machine, you know, the way that it's presented in Black Panther or in many other science fiction movies or books, this is not how a nano machine would behave. And we want to look at what is the foundation of a nano machine. We would look to inspiration where nano machines already exist, which is in nature. You know, nature is very good at creating nano scale things that perform a function. And so either in how very small life forms behave, in how viruses behave, in how very small proteins behave, right? These are nano machines, and they perform very simple, but ultimately when aggregated, very powerful functions. So I don't know if I'd say that the Black Panther suit, almost as a nanite conglomerate or going around your body, necessarily has a foundation in science, but I would say that some of the functionality of the suit could be empowered by other forms of nanotechnology, not the nanite.
Gotcha. So in particular, how about that absorbing, storing, and redirecting energy part?
The thing that makes his suit really cool. You know, I saw in a previous episode of this, the vibranium episode, that you guys talked about supercapacitors in the suit. And that's a great example of how you could store a very volume efficient energy storage for short-term storage of electrical energy. When I look at the suit, I'm thinking, what does the suit do? Okay, so it has a kinetic impact. It turns that into energy somehow. It stores that energy and then later projects that energy out into its environment. As a matter of fact, yes, there are examples of nano devices that can absorb kinetic energy and turn them into electrical energy. And these are called piezoelectrics. And actually, you'd be very familiar with piezoelectrics from your everyday life, because they start your grills.
In telephones.
They're in telephones for filters. What a piezoelectric does, it doesn't have to be nanoscale. A piezoelectric crystal, you know, quartz is an example of one of these. When you put mechanical stress on a piezoelectric material, it produces an electrical bias. So what I can do and what's been envisioned is, okay, could I envision a surface covered in tiny little piezoelectric wires so that when they're put under pressure, those wires bend. And when they bend, they generate an electrical field. And, you know, I can take that, that's energy, it's electrical energy. I can put that into a supercapacitor for later use. Now, you know, we can talk about, would they really absorb energy from a bullet? You know, unlikely.
It seems that a wire would be defeated by a bullet. Maybe
indeed. But, you know, at least this idea of, could I take a physical impulse? Could I take something hitting a surface and turn that into electrical energy with nanotechnology? Absolutely, you could. Yeah.
All right. Well, there you have it. Black Panther supersuit, totally real. That's what I got out of that.
Yeah, the Eric thumbs up.
And here's where we start getting into conspiracy theory territory. Sarah, do you know of the connection between nanomachines and COVID vaccines, which was not supposed to rhyme?
I mean, I have a guess. Is the guess that the vaccine is not like the MMR vaccine, for example, that gives you like a small dose of the disease that your body then builds up antibodies to, but that the vaccine actually adjusts your RNA? Is that right?
It does. Yeah.
You know, that's why people are coming up with conspiracy theories, like you said, Dave, about what's going to happen to me in 5 years. Will I have a third eye or whatever?
Right.
I don't know. Is that what you were talking about?
A little bit, yeah. As a clarification for those that might be concerned about whether or not the vaccine is going to have long-lasting effects, it is going to sort of edit a bit of RNA, which is downstream of your DNA. Your DNA is going to influence, so to speak, your RNA, which is then going to do the things we want it to do to prevent infection and symptoms of COVID. But it's important to note that that is not a permanent change. And also, it cannot go back up the stream and affect your DNA, which affects things like, well, the number of eyes you have and other things. And also, caveat, I haven't had a biology class since 1997. So read somebody else who has had one more recently. But there exists a QAnon adjacent conspiracy theory, and I would recommend anybody that's interested in the QAnon conspiracy theories to not read them because they're horrifying and ridiculous.
That guy's brain is a bag full of cats.
But there exists a conspiracy theory that in particular Bill Gates has somehow put, and this is usually the word they use, microchips or nanites into the COVID-19 vaccine, often with the idea that we'll be tracked somehow and or interacting with 5G. It gets pretty wild. Eric, just to be perfectly clear, are there nanomachines in COVID vaccines? You sort of answered this already by saying nanomachines that we, mechanical ones, aren't a thing. But just to be clear, are there nanomachines in COVID vaccines?
I would certainly say that there are not microchips in the vaccine. Yeah. Oftentimes we look to the natural world for where there are examples of you know, nano phenomena or nano machines, you know, actually in operation. And so it's a tough thing because I don't want to say, yes, there are nano machines in the vaccine. What I'll say is there are no microchips in the vaccine. And beyond that, why would I need to put microchips in the vaccine? Every single person who's a vaccine skeptic carries a smartphone. If I'm going to put a microchip on you, you already have one in your pocket.
What I sometimes forget is that I often think of technology as this like purely artificial thing, that like technology is the smartphone or the television or the microwave or whatever, these things that we make in factories, but that there's other ways of thinking about what is technology. And like it sounds to me like you're sort of suggesting, and correct me if I'm wrong, that like nature is a kind of technology, just the way like storytelling is a kind of technology. It's a tool that we use for a purpose. Is nature technology?
Yeah, I understand what you're trying to get at. You know, it's interesting. I suppose like when we define technology, we almost define it as not nature.
Yeah.
We almost define technology as the things that we do that are outside of nature. And I think that's a very fundamental like paradigm in the mentality of what technology is, that especially now we're kind of questioning, not in the sense of like, is nature a form of technology, but rather what nature is that it's a system of processing information. And over many billions of years, coming up with answers to optimization questions, right? And so what we want to do with technology, you know, technology also is looking for answers to optimization questions, like how do I quickly get from Seattle to DC? An answer to that question has resulted in the modern airport infrastructure. But a lot of times there are other questions of like, how do I get cells to heal more quickly? Or are there ways that I can turn your muscle tissue to regrow neural tissue, which is notoriously difficult to regenerate? And so in those cases, it's often not best for us to, from the ground up, try to answer those questions. Oftentimes, the best thing is to say, let's look at nature, which is itself a system for processing information and coming up with solutions. Let's see what solutions they've come up with. And that's where I think the overlap of nature and technology is that nature has solved many of these problems. An animal body, the human body, is an enormous engineering challenge that nature figured out over billions of years. Humans starting from scratch for many of those questions, you're going uphill. But if you can look to ways that nature has solved some of these problems, how do I store energy with a great amount of volumetric density? These are answers that we can borrow from nature if we know where to look. And that's a big part of nanotechnology.
Cool. That helps me, I think, distinguish those two concepts and see where there are parallels. I think it's also quite poetic. You know, I'm an English teacher. So so that helps me think about nanotechnology without understanding some of the mechanics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sarah, on the topic of conspiracy theories more generally, what do you think about the impulse to believe that there are like huge government efforts to do things like secretly implant microchips or nanochips in us and things like that?
You know, Dave, I don't know how much time we have on this podcast, but I've thought about this for a really long time. You know, as I just mentioned, and I know you mentioned in the intro, I'm an English teacher, so I trade in stories. And I live for stories. And that's not just as a English teacher, but that's as a human being. I think we are one of the things for which human beings seem built or prone to or longing for is stories. And I think one of the things that we use stories for is to explain our world, the parts of our world that we don't understand, but we experience, particularly the parts of our world that we don't control and that we experience. And, you know, I could spend a lot of time like waxing and wondering about why it is in this moment that it seems that there must just be a more and more vocal part of the community that is clinging to conspiracy theories. I don't think it's a new thing. I think it's newly amplified by technologies like the internet and the longing to explain the unexplainable in a way that grants us more control and power than we feel we have in our own lives. I think that's where that comes from. It's like this craving for stories coupled with a sense of a lack of power and maybe a dash of paranoia that we all have. And we just all have different levels of answering those stories and different levels of comfort with mystery and authority. And that's my answer to that. I'm not sure if that fully answers your question.
Well, it's very comforting. The nature of a conspiracy theory always is that someone's behind it, right? And it's very comforting right. that problems are the result of a group of people or even just Bill Gates pulling these levers rather than emergent phenomenon from a complex system that is, you know, impossible for any one person to understand. That's frightening.
Much less improve, right? Like, indeed. How does one improve one's lot, particularly if one is struggling or suffering or in some way, to pull from the New York Times recent piece, the languishing of not just one's life during the quarantine and the pandemic, but like if one looks at one's future and sees, you know, economic distress or a lack of opportunity or not what I was promised or I've been wronged or whatever, and you don't see a way out, it's really easy to find a story or be tempted by a story that explains all of that with a villain. Why are the Marvel stories so appealing? There is a villain. The villain is defeated. Not easily, but the villain is defeated. And I think the other thing about conspiracy theories that makes them comforting is that every piece of evidence fits, and that which does not fit is disregarded or explained away in with some mechanism within the story. And wouldn't it be nice if every piece of evidence that one could possibly have could fit neatly into one grand story?
Everything is connected.
I'm not persuaded that life is that simple.
And Eric, you work at DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which has been connected by conspiracy theorists to maybe every single conspiracy theory
indeed.
At some point. People probably believe you built the pyramids. But and look, I don't think anybody can deny that governments sometimes do things secretly, and some of those secretive things are unethical. I'm thinking Tuskegee, Iran-Contra, or even like the pseudoscientific psychic research like DARPA's Stargate program, the men who stare at goats and those sorts of way out there ideas. But I'm wondering what your take is from maybe that perspective on how the general public can separate potential fact from conspiracy theory in at least this area.
It's definitely challenging. There has to be a reluctance to just lean on appeals to authority, obviously, when we have such a rich history of a misuse of authority. And of course, it's also challenging to just tell someone, well, you know, lean on your best judgment, when advances in communication technology have sort of thrown a deluge of sources at everyone all the time, to sort of lean on some of what Sarah said. Whatever story you want to find, you can find it. You can find evidence for it, and you can find a narrative that's being sold. So it's definitely challenging. I would say that there, of course, is a combination of leaning on traditional, respectable sources when it's like scientific research and concepts, although there are limitations and there are systematic problems with the peer review process that have been pointed out before. You don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You don't say that we know that there are problems in these things, so we're just going to ignore all, right? The scientific process is still strong. It is still valuable to lean on peer review, to still lean on those institutions that hold that institutional knowledge and follow their lead, while also understanding that no one's saying you should not look at those with a critical eye.
That's great. Thanks. I appreciate that. Okay, back to some comic book nonsense. That was way too deep for this show. Other than Iron Man's suit in the last two Avengers movies, which seems to be the same as the Black Panther suit, at least in theory, that's the last we hear about nanotechnology specifically. But Sarah, what do you know about Spider-Man's webbing?
I know it comes out of his wrists.
Is this stuff coming out of you?
Ooh.
No.
That's a Tobey Maguire foul. I'm we got sorry. A universe. I need a wrong universe klaxon or something.
You're saying there's a multiverse?
Wrist-mounted projectors,
yeah.
So in a sense, you're not totally...
Yeah, yeah,
okay,
yeah.
I'm not. I haven't fully watched all of the movies.
No problem.
To my shame. But let's just go ahead and say I don't know much.
That's fine. In episode 9 of this show, Spider-Man does whatever he wants. Once I started getting clever with the titles, arachnologist Sebastian Echeverri told Emily Osterhuis and I about real spider webs. But Eric, you mentioned in an email you thought that Spider-Man's webbing might be able to be explained by nanotechnology. What's your theory?
Yeah, I suppose we're forming a central thesis of this episode, which is that we look to inspiration in nature for where nanotechnology can make a big impact. And so certainly I would say that if I wanted to make a substance that was extremely strong and potentially extremely sticky, I could think of nanotechnology as a way of addressing that. So obviously the structure of spider silk itself, its strength is derived in part from its molecular structure, which is on the nanoscale. Spider silk is a great example of something that is enormously strong for how lightweight it is, because it leverages the strength of its molecular bonds. But that wouldn't have to be it. There are other places I could look. So for example, very famously, the case of carbon nanotubes. I can make fibers that are very lightweight and very strong. And it's challenged to scale the production of things like carbon nanotubes, which are very, very small, scale those up into a substance that's large enough to make, not that this is what we're trying to make, but to make sticky webbing out of it. You know, another good example is there's another material that I certainly would urge people to look into, because it's been up and coming. Carbon nanotubes is one we might have heard of for quite some time, but there's another material called nanocellulose, which is a very fascinating material. Essentially, we have developed processes to isolate the tiny little crystal-like molecule or substance that makes cellulose or wood material that makes them strong and lightweight. And if you isolate those and then put them all together or even add them as additives into plastics or metals, they can make things that are very strong and very lightweight, much in the same way that carbon nanotubes do. But now, because they're coming from cellulose, they're biodegradable. I can source them from a renewable source, right? So I can manufacture them out of wood pulp or even recycling, even paper. So nanocellulose is a very interesting emerging area that could be used if I wanted to make a sticky, strong substance, could be used as an additive into that.
I expect then we'll see as many popular science articles on nanocellulose as we have on carbon nanotubes, which seem to be the answer to literally every sci-fi problem.
Yeah.
Next up, we have a segment in the show called Technically. Sarah and I are going to keep quiet for 2 or 3 minutes as Eric gives us some nuance or details on anything related even tangentially to the topic. Eric, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. So yeah, I realize that I've hit on a common thread throughout this talk of, you know, looking into nature for where inspiration can come from, nanotechnology. I'm going to diverge a little bit away from that into an area that leverages phenomena on the nanoscale that is very much a man-made thing. Although maybe towards the end of it, we can see how it's veering into where nature is. And that's the idea of nanoelectronics and microelectronics. And nanoelectronics is a huge part of the Marvel Universe in a way that isn't necessarily a spotlight isn't shown on it, but I will look at examples of the capabilities of Iron Man's suit. I will look at examples of the autonomous drones in the Spider-Man Far From Home, which are capable of autonomous navigation, are capable of spitting out a large amount of energy. You know, certainly Iron Man's suit and Spider-Man's suit at some point as well can take in and process an enormous amount of information and then spit that out as actionable advice to Spider-Man or to Iron Man. And I don't know if they dwell on these as long as they should. This is actually extremely powerful. I mean, our computational technology in the size and energy use that's displayed in the Marvel Universe is nowhere near that. But I will say that over the past, 20 years or so, there's been an enormous amount of research in how you make computational technology better from the base materials. So quantum computing, photonic computing, so using light instead of electrical impulses, a paradigm called neuromorphic computing, where instead of the conventional wave computing, we look at how the brain, the animal brain does computing and see if we can do computer architecture that way to do very efficient processing. These are all areas of active research, and they all leverage nanoscale phenomena. And sort of what I said at the beginning, that nanotechnology is really all around us, not just in the natural world, but nanotechnology is in your pocket, it's in your car now, in the form of nanoelectronics. And so this is certainly something that is highly relevant to my work at DARPA, something that we care about a lot, but it's something that, is in all sectors, really, as computers become more powerful and use up more energy. I want to be able to do computations. I want the Iron Man suit to be able to look around and identify friend from foe, but I also don't want my computer to get so hot that it catches on fire, or I don't want Iron Man. It's not very fun if Iron Man has to plug into the wall to get enough energy to do the computation that his suit needs to do. And so that's an area where there are a lot of advances getting made in nanotechnology. And it's an area where you can really see an impact in both the Marvel Universe, which takes advantage of these things, but which also are very impactful in your everyday life.
That's fascinating. Iron Man does solve a lot of these energy problems with what is essentially an unlimited energy source in his chest, the arc reactor. I tried to figure out how to get an expert to talk about that, but the thing is, it's just a box of infinite energy in his chest.
It's why we don't try to necessarily address infinity stones fully either, when the point of them is that they're a little magical box.
I've had a couple of geologists get in contact with me, and I'm like, all I got is they're kind of gems. That's all I got.
Do we have reality warping gems? or do we not? Okay, we don't.
It'd be a very quick episode. Sarah, close us out. What are your final teeny tiny thoughts?
My nano thoughts. Well, listen, I know a lot more about nanotechnology than I did when this podcast started. Even in our conversation before recording, I was thinking like, oh man, I still really feel out of my depth. I'll tell you my final thought is I think that there is a lot of technology that I wander around my life being completely and totally unaware of. And I think that like that whole idea of looking at the processes that are happening on a really small scale and leveraging what we understand about those processes and structures that then occur on massive number of times, like what you mentioned, something happening a billion times, even if it's at the scale of 1/1,000,000th of a meter or whatever, is really interesting to me when I think about like power and how that approach to nanotechnology is also one way of approaching human power, right? Like understanding what's happening in one person, right? Like focusing on the small and leveraging those things, those structures and processes that can then have an enormous effect is about taking small amounts of power and reproducing them. And we see that in mass movements, in like, you know, massive amounts of communication. That's something that I'm going to walk away thinking about is power, I think, and the degree to which nanotechnology and also the process that you described of nanotechnology as like a field of study is about leveraging and growing power.
That's a fascinating way to look at that. I really like that. I want to be clear, as always, that I love these movies. Scientific accuracy is not a necessary component for good storytelling. In fact, sometimes it gets in the way. I want to thank my guests, Sarah Miller and Eric Breckenfeld, for being on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and cross your fingers that there's an episode 15. That's all for this episode. Thanks once again to my guests, Eric Breckenfeld and Sarah Miller. The way they were able to make a seemingly esoteric topic really relevant and meaningful means a lot to me. I'm going to ask you a favor during the credits now. Share this episode with one friend you think would like it. And if you want to go a step further, I'll ask what every small podcast asks, to rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. If you want to go nuts, support the podcast directly at patreon.com/marvelsofscience. MCU audio clips were taken from Avengers, Avengers Age of Ultron, Thor the Dark World, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Captain America Civil War, and Spider-Man Far From Home, and all used entirely without permission. The music is a song called On Tiptoe from Purple Planet Music. That song and more royalty-free music can be found at purple-planet.com. Check out more info about each episode and its guests, including upcoming episodes, at davereinersman.com/marvelsofscience. And now find me on Twitter at @marvelsoscience. Thanks for listening.